Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey, you guys.
How are you guys doing? Happy listening day.
Happy day that ends in Y.
Oh my gosh, you got them.
All of them. How are you? What are you doing? How's your summer, if it's summer where you are?
Yeah, what have you been up to? What are your like hobbies that you're getting into right now?
I am starting to feel like the fall influences like seeping in August. I went to the grocery store. They have Halloween candy out.
Yeah, they do.
First of all, anybody buying Halloween candy right now is buying it for themselves. So
truly,
that's a fact.
Because if you're planning to give that to children, you know it's going to be stale in almost 2 months.
More than 2 months, right? And also, what, are you just going to look at it for 2 months? Like,
get real. Grow up.
Please.
You're going to eat the candy.
Don't lie to me. We listen and we don't judge, but do not lie to me. So that's funny. Oh. But I'm like itching to decorate for fall.
Yeah.
I love fall fashion. I love comfy sweaters and leggings and cute little sneakers and where are we going and get a little coffee and walk and just do all the things that we want to do because it's all the things.
I feel like August is like a very thin veil because it's still like you still get summer heat. Like we're still pretty much at the peak of summer heat.
Yes.
And then suddenly and very quickly it goes from like, oh, summer to it's fall.
Yes.
Right now. We're putting on practical magic right now.
So, and yeah, and my birthday is the beginning of September.
Yeah.
So it's technically over the summer.
Yeah.
But I always feel like, no, it's a fall birthday. Like, if it's my birthday,
it's now fall.
It's now fall. My candles have changed.
Yeah.
The decorations in the house have changed. I'm itching to wear flannels.
Yes.
And comfy sweaters with cute little vests like that. Please.
Did I tell you I hit the mother load thrifting the other day?
You did tell me, but I need to hear more about it.
I got a vintage, like vintage L.L. Bean flannel for $3.
Yes.
$3. And it's like, it kind of looks like a shacket. It's one of those where it's not like plaid. There's nothing on it. It's just literally a flannel. It's gray. It's beautiful. It's perfect. It's everything I could have ever wanted for a flannel in like a capsule wardrobe.
You probably would have paid $60 for it if you saw it in a store. But even better, you saw it already loved and $3. Yes,
already loved and $3. And like, what's more sustainable and better for my wallet than that? It was bopping.
Thrifting. Oh my gosh. So good.
I also got a pair of American Eagle jeans for $2.50.
Nice.
And like a full dress. It was so good. It was so good.
I tend to love the way American Eagle jeans fit
and
that they have the short leg.
Yeah, they have the short option.
Which for me is absolutely necessary. I mean, I still like roll them, but like when I was in high school, when it was like the long skinny jeans, like everyone went to Hollister and you paid at that time like $70 for like paper thin shit jeans.
Yep.
I would obviously have like a pair, but they were so long that like they went around my foot and off of it.
Aww.
Like that's how, because everything was just long and skinny, and at the time it was skinny, like I was skinny, but I did not have the length, and so I didn't and now I don't even bother to look. But like I appreciate when a company has like short or extra short.
Yeah, like different lengths are important. And like I am a little bit tall, so there are some brands, not a lot, but like jeans where they're totally fine if I'm standing up. Then the second I sit down, it looks like I picked the totally wrong size and they're like floods and I look like a teenage boy who's outgrowing everything they get in like 2 weeks, which sucks because I'm not. Hey. So I get you. The length matters.
It does.
But it was a good thrift haul. It was a good day.
I love a good thrift haul. I also love going. We went a few weeks ago. We went to just some old like furniture consignment shop.
Yeah.
And obviously we didn't get anything because
we don't need furniture.
We don't need furniture. But I love looking at all like the old loved things, like seeing the 60s dressers that are like rounded at the top and like everything kind of has that like rainbow shape kind of like bowing at the top. I'm just like, that is such a capsule, you know what I mean? Like that's like,
yeah,
you go right back in time when you're looking at that. And I just think it's so, I was just born in the wrong time and I
Well, don't worry. There's going to be stuff this age that people think that about too.
I know, but like, I love all the old, like, I love 50s, 60s, yeah. 70s furniture.
It's fun.
And
I liked a lot of the decor in that era, but I did not like the green carpet.
No, not the,
that wasn't for me.
Not the wood paneling, none of that stuff. I mean, that's more like 70s, but, and I don't have plastic on my furniture.
Yeah, true that. But
I would probably save it for my cats, honestly.
Yeah.
My cats can be assholes.
Yeah, but that's okay.
But I love and adore them and would do anything for them.
Newt's been on a tyrant lately, but...
Is he ever not on a tyrant?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're trying topical Prozac for him.
Oh.
Yeah.
How's that going?
Good when I can get it on him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that just the way?
Honestly, I do like it better than the pills because he outsmarted the pills right quick, but it's so early that I can't like tell if it's helping.
Right.
But we'll find out. What else have you been up to? I know you've been reading.
Yes. Well, I finished my book, the same book that I've been talking about for months because I had put it down and I just did not pick it back up and I should have.
No, it happens.
It's actually such a good book. Would definitely recommend it. Although I think it already kind of like had its time. I think people have already read it. But
what's it called again?
It's Local Woman Missing.
Okay.
By Mary Kubica? Stand by. Kubica. K-U-B-I-C-A.
Okay.
Kubica.
Sure.
Kubica. I don't know. By her. And I did like her writing style and I did like how it kind of jumped in time and like POV.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to read another book of hers to see if they all kind of follow that. But I'm open to book recommendations. I like fiction, true crimey, thriller, mystery type.
Yeah.
Really could give a shit about romance or rom-com. I really don't care.
I do think you'd love that book that I recommended the other day, How to Solve Your Own Murder, because that gives that like Sherlock Holmesy kind of decade jumping POVs, but it's easy to follow.
I'm gonna need that.
And then the other one, well, actually, I just finished one that I really liked called Everyone in My Family Has Killed Somebody or Killed Someone. Nice. It's really good. It's kind of a funny take on it because the narrator is an author who writes how to write true crime or like how to write mystery books. So he doesn't write them, but he writes like the guides for writers who write them.
Okay, interesting.
And that's the narrator. So it's kind of funky where he's like, well, no, these are like the deduction reasoning law, like quote unquote laws of writing these things. So it's kind of fun. It's a different little lens on it, but I like that.
Oh.
And it was Sherlock Holmesy enough, like there was enough deduction and like little things to figure out that it was really fun.
All right. I'm going to have to read that.
Yeah, they're good. And both of those are series. I think there's like three in each, but.
Oh, I'll mess that right up.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been fun. So, okay. Now that we do our little book corner, whenever we're done with books.
I know.
Which is kind of crazy and cool and fun. I know, what are you guys reading?
We're so old now.
I know.
We're not like, oh, we went to the club and we didn't know. We're like, so what did you read?
Yeah. Welcome to your elder 20s.
I know.
Oh, please. We're only in our 20s. We're fine.
But like my back and the way my knees crack tell me otherwise.
Well, they're telling you that we're in our elder 20s. But I'm really excited to get into it today. I can't even lie to you. I'm so excited.
The only thing I know about this case is that we may have multiple parts.
It is a two-parter.
And that we're going on a wild ride.
Yeah, you're going to need to buckle the fuck up.
All right, 5-point harness. Let's do it.
Yes. So, yoo-hoo, pods on. We're hopping into it.
Ooh.
Hi, hello, and welcome, or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
You guys.
As you may or may not know, Allie and I pull out cases every single week for this podcast for true crime or criminal justice related topics that we can share with all of you and also each other. We are nerds with a capital N, and despite over 10 years combined of education and experience in the field, we each tell each other a case the other one has usually no idea about, and we go through it with our little unique lens on it all. But at least for me, Abby, I find that sometimes the repetition in these cases can be a little bit disheartening and awful.
Yeah, and give you belly aches.
Yeah, and we do our very best every single time to bring light and consideration to the victims in each of these cases, to perspective take, and some surprise me, no doubt, but often you see the same patterns. The phrase, the husband did it, isn't so off because often some of the most incredibly dark acts are committed by the people closest to you. Some, on the other hand, are truly sad because they're generally senseless and there's randomness to the attacks, and that's scary in its own right. And fewer still are truly surprising. We covered Tim Bosma's truck a while ago.
Yes, we did.
And then there was the Rolex killer. So there are a few cases that just kind of whiplash you from twists and turns I never thought to even consider when it comes to cases that we cover. And today, we're starting the first of a two-part series that is so crazy, I didn't think anyone could make this shit up.
Okay, so it's one of those.
As a reminder, I tend to take an armchair psychologist lens to this, and I am not a licensed therapist, I'm not a doctor, and my perception is only that. Not formal diagnoses, advice, or anything of the such, but when we have cases like this, I just can't help to speculate. So before we hop all the way into it, as per the usual, I'll just do a few source shout-outs and trigger warnings. As always, you have access to all of the sources we used directly or linked in our show notes below, based on how long they are. But today, I used a documentary from 2012 that's in the notes, but if I tell you now, it might spoil some things, like the name of it.
Yeah, don't say it.
No. I also used an amazing article from The New Yorker, Investigation Discovery, The Charlie Project, and a huge shout out to the Crime Creepers podcast. They had really great, thorough research on this, and one of the hosts on this series was a federal agent, which is cool. But as for trigger warnings, this case involves conversation on substance use disorder, children and teens kind of in general, deception, bad accents that I promise I'll try not to do too much of.
Oh, there it is. Much of.
And then obviously in the next episode, we'll talk more. But today there's also just, I'll give you a trigger warning before we go into it, but some pretty graphic descriptions of like abuse of children and sex crimes.
All right.
Okay. All right. So with all of that being said, today we're talking about the disappearance of Nicholas Barclay.
I have not heard that name before.
I think some people who have been in the true crime field for like a hot minute will probably know this one, but I haven't heard it come up in the last 5-10 years.
Okay.
Today, our story starts in 1980 in a small rural town outside of San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
Beverly Dollarhide gave birth on December 31st of 1980 to a baby boy named Nicholas.
A New Year's Eve baby.
A New Year's Eve baby. Nicky, as his family called him, had a huge personality. He loved Michael Jackson, playing with friends and being outside, but he was also a little bit of a troublemaker. So we're going to jump forward to 1994.
So he's 14.
13 technically, because he won't really turn 14 until like basically 1985. True. Yeah. But yeah, he is 13 and Nicholas Barclay already had a juvenile record. Breaking and entering, threatening teachers, stealing, truancy, and he had runaway behaviors.
Okay.
And I just want to say, this beginning part has a little bit of conjecture setting up an education for you. So, as someone who's worked in and around both the criminal justice field and the mental health field, it comes as absolutely zero surprise to me that Beverly, his mother, had struggles of her own. Although Nicky was born into a family that loved him very much, his family structure was unique. He lived with his mom, Beverly, and recently his older brother, Jason, had moved in. Beverly did have two older children, Jason and Carrie, who I believe are both in their 20s, so much older than Nicholas, moved out of the house, kind of. And these siblings were from an earlier marriage.
Okay.
So Beverly was married and divorced, but she never got married to Nikki's dad, and he didn't have really any relationship with him. I don't think they really knew each other.
Okay.
And while I can't 100% confirm, I believe both Jason and Carrie were technically Dollar Hides, because I think Beverly kept her last name from the first marriage.
Got it.
Yes. So.
So Barclay is the dad's last name.
Yeah. Barclay is only Nikki's last name. Everybody else is a Dollar Hide. I'm pretty sure.
And he got that from his dad.
Yes.
Okay.
Carrie had kids of her own, not much younger than Nikki, and I believe Jason was doing his own thing out in Utah, like just sort of like hanging out, being around. So Beverly, acting as mom to two young adults, a young teen with behavioral challenges, and now also grandmother, and still trying to actively make ends meet herself and everyone else. She's got a lot going on. And on top of that, she struggled significantly with Nikki. His behaviors obviously weren't okay. And it seemed like no matter what she did, it didn't help.
Mm-hmm.
She couldn't ground him because he'd just run away. And that's terrifying. But like, he'd just run away. She couldn't really take anything away from him because they didn't really have a lot for her to take back.
Right.
And if she yelled, he blocked it out. She had to work to provide and she tried to parent. But eventually she called Jason to see if he'd come home to help with Nikki, to see if, I don't know, maybe having more family or more supervision or even maybe a male role model would do the trick she just couldn't seem to get with him.
Mm.
So that's how Jason came to move home.
Okay.
But Beverly had more struggles as well. Not only did Beverly work 7 nights a week at the graveyard shift at Dunkin' Donuts, she struggled significantly with substance use disorder and specifically heroin. And while she got and often struggled to stay sober during Nicholas's childhood, she wasn't a bad mom, according to her daughter. Carrie said she was probably the most functioning addict she'd ever met. They always had a nice house. They always had things. They always had food on the table. And while Beverly could certainly be described as having a tough exterior, the people she loved essentially called her a teddy bear because she was so kind and loving to her people.
Mm-hmm.
But Beverly was really having a hard time. So just as a little note here, I want to paint a little picture of what this life sounds like to me and talk a little bit about substance use disorder as like a mental health condition.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll keep going with this. But just so you know, we're having a little teeny tiny pin.
Mm-hmm.
I want to paint a little picture here of what this lifestyle sounds like to me. I don't know how Beverly got addicted, but it sounds to me like she grew up in the school of hard knocks, you know, one way or another, be it a one-time choice, a repeated choice, the aftermath of poor prescriptions after surgery or an injury or somebody else's choice, she got hooked on opiates. Now, I don't talk on much with authority here, but having the work experience I do, I think I can at least sort of speak to some of the ways this looks behind closed doors, like how these words are words that paint a good picture, but it's certainly not the whole picture. There's a general cycle I've seen, and there's some biology I want to talk about because Beverly does things I disagree with later, and I have a lot of questions for her that I likely won't ever get answered. But I want to give her all of the credit I can because hearing this sounds like one thing, but in my experience, can look a lot different than just what you see at face value. Addiction seems to be different than other mental illnesses because it tends to be one that is generally stereotyped as immoral or more chosen than others. And a disclaimer here, again, I'm not a therapist, I'm not licensed, but I am also not saying anything to like blame anyone or judge anyone from their perspective, or to say that other disorders are bad. I'm not trying to like put other things on the same playing field. I'm trying to take the stereotype maybe and the bias down a little bit on this one.
Mm-hmm.
So for context, first, everything is a choice.
Yep.
I have diagnosed OCD. I do repetitive behavior sometimes, like check that the door is locked or that the oven is off. And these are active behaviors. These are choices. But because they can seem protective or positive or generally harmless when it comes to overdoing them, people don't often tell me that I need to just have more willpower than the compulsions.
Mm-hmm.
And just because I'm on a soapbox here, no, not all OCD is cutesy, girly, clean, and Mr. Monk touching everything he walks past and washing your hands 100 times a day. It fucking sucks. But that's not the point. Like everything, there is a normal amount of symptoms or phenomenon or feeling that we experience in healthy degrees. But when it's a disorder, it's out of your hands, and it happens more than that. Anxiety and depression, for instance, are commonly known kinds of emotions that are usually associated with the disorder rather than just the feeling. But everybody experiences these. Anxiety and fear keep us alive. They create instinct and help us remember to be careful about the situations that we're in that could be dangerous. And depression is natural. The longer you live, the more likely you are to experience something bad that can cause bouts of it. But these are only disorders when they are significantly higher than average, and then they impact your daily living for long periods of time. Many people get dependent on caffeine or melatonin or even sugar. But if you don't have an addiction disorder, you likely can buckle down and get out of it if you try. It's hard, and anyone who's tried to cut off coffee or sugar knows that the first few days suck. But then they get better. But for people with this disorder, it's not like that. The information I'm about to share is from News and Health, a reputable.gov website link that is down below, so you can check it out. Everything is. So this isn't empathy or over-exaggeration, but coming right now is science from people much smarter than me. Addiction rewires the brain, and there are genuinely bad biological repercussions in addictive substances. Dr. George Kube, a director on alcohol abuse and addiction for News and Health, says that the brain actually changes with addiction, and the more drugs or alcohol you've taken, the more disruptive it is to the brain. Each time, the trick with an addiction disorder is that it hijacks your brain and rewires the reward center. A healthy brain rewards you for healthy behavior, like eating, sleeping, bonding with loved ones, sex, like all of those things that are good for the body and the species kind mm-hmm. of thing. And the dopamine you get from that makes you feel good for doing the thing that's good for you, so you continue to do it. A brain that's ill from addiction starts to rewire so that your brain rewards the use of addictive substances, be it alcohol, opiates, shopping, eating, you name it, and it slowly begins to take over the reward response as a whole. And then, of course, for specific drugs like opiates, they come with natural serotonin dumps that make you feel great from what you did. And then the addiction adds on top of that the same dopamine you'd get if you were eating salads and ice cream, girl dinner, after a jog with your best friend in the whole wide world. So like you're not only getting the one rush of good feeling from taking the thing, but you're getting that second reward dump, basically the dopamine.
From your own brain.
From your own brain saying that was good. We need to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
And your brain slowly starts to believe it and prioritize that over other things. And much more quickly with addiction, your neural pathways rewire, damage your frontal lobe, and shown in brain imaging studies, like you get less activity in your frontal lobe, which makes those complex decisions that thinks about consequences in the future. Like the critical thinking to make those in the moment choices that can better your life down the road is genuinely like being killed off.
Right. Your brain focuses on the here and now and is a lot more apt to impulsive decision making rather than like critical thinking.
Right. So now not only is your reward center hijacked, it's only giving you this good feeling when you're doing this addictive substance that gives you this other good feeling. But the part of your brain that might be able to combat that and fight it is damaged and not working. In brain imaging studies, it's shown to have like significantly less activity after substance use. And for opiates specifically, this is now information from Medline Plus in a different News and Health article, but withdrawal can be unbearable. You get flu-like symptoms, goosebumps, vomiting, nausea, you can't sleep, and your nervous system becomes so overly sensitive that it overreacts to everything. It's like a flu and a migraine for your entire body. And this, along with the changing reward systems in your brain, keep people with substance use addiction as a disorder coming back, and even more so for people with opiate addiction specifically. We know now there are significantly more treatment options for substance use disorder. Like, your brain can be rewired back to a degree. It takes a long time. If you look it up, I know there are some really good resources. If you literally just Google like rewiring the brain addiction, sometimes it can take anywhere from like 6 to 14 months. But if you think of your neural pathways as kind of like a sledding hill, you know, the more times you go down a sledding path, the faster it gets. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to change that route, maybe somewhere in the middle, it's going to take a lot of work every time to slowly start to like, you know, scoot your little boot in the other direction.
Right.
And maybe it's really hard the first time and it's pretty hard the next few times. But then suddenly you keep going down, there's another snow, and the new path is the one that you go down automatically.
Right. And it's not that people are unable to overcome them. Like, there is hope. That is,
yeah,
people recover. This can happen. The root of it is with everything, choices and it what is. You decide. But I think the stigma to substance use is, well, you chose to do that every day, which factually, yes, right? It is a choice, unless somebody's using against their will, like someone is forcing that, which certainly does happen.
Yeah.
But the activity in the brain, it is not like you or I making a decision to do or not do something. It is so much deeper than that and so much more complex. So I think like the stigma comes from like, well, why can't you just stop?
Yeah, just stop buying it, just stop doing it.
And people can stop. People do heal, people do recover, people can absolutely recover from this and live a full and happy life.
And that's why, though.
But it isn't as easy as someone saying, well, just wake up today and decide no. For some people,
right,
that people can happen.
That don't have this as a mental health disorder, right? Someone who, like just you or I, addicted to caffeine, mm-hmm, and you want to knock it off, it is going to suck, but you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas people where this is a disorder within the brain, your brain is biologically changing. Some things are dying, but like that cognition is now at a different level. So they absolutely can, but they need so much more support to do so and a good set of circumstances to sort of set them up for success on the aftermath, which is why I am so grateful that here in the year of 2025, we've gained so many resources.
Mm-hmm.
We now have detox where people can go to safely withdraw from drugs that can be, mm-hmm, sort of medically supervised and make sure they're okay. We have rehab centers where it is sober, drug-free, like those temptations that can really, again, your brain is rewiring pathways. It is relearning other reward systems. And while it's doing that, to not have the option to have your drug of choice is hugely helpful. It's, mm-hmm, so beneficial. And then to also create communities of people who are sober, who will help you when your own brain can't necessarily make those choices at the beginning, who can say, nope, we're not doing that because we want to be sober and we want you to be sober. And they're people you trust and respect and you'll listen to.
Yeah, they hold you accountable. You hold them accountable.
Right. It's important and it's so helpful and it does work. Again, like sometimes, yes, brain cells die and you can't replace those. They don't come back. But you can always rechange the way you're thinking and that will always change the way you act. So there is hope for this. Many people successfully recover. But we also are still learning about it. You know,
we don't know everything there is to know yet, but we know a hell of a lot more than we used to.
Right.
And all of that to say it's not as simple as
just stop.
Yes.
And I also think that like you know, I'm hopeful in the next 25 years, we'll say, oh my God, we had nothing back then compared to what we have now, mm-hmm. which is what I'm about to say in the 90s. I mean, now we have, you know, all of those things. We also have drug replacement therapy where
we have harm reduction medications.
Right.
Have,
like methadone, Suboxone, Subutex. These are all meds that can help curb those cravings, mm-hmm. can help sort of like, I'm going to say with a big quote again, I'm not super knowledgeable on these specific drugs. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a licensed mm-hmm. psychologist, but like sort of healthily help you take down the level of opiates in your system. Like there are really good things we have now. And hopefully we get more of later. But we're just even now starting to see some of the biological effects, like with the technology to do brain scans and all of these things. The science develops. We're always learning more. And hopefully that means we can always help more.
So in Beverly's case, was she an addict before she had her son, Nikki?
Yes. Okay. I believe she had been for quite some time. I don't know when she started using, but given the fact that Carrie could comment on it,
Yep.
I'd say it was probably a while.
So that, and that puts him at a predisposition anyway, biologically.
Yeah.
But also, not that we know this, I don't know if you go into it or not, but if she was using during pregnancy, that changes a lot for him as well. So like he has almost a lot of things working against him in his ability to stay sober in the future as an adult or teen.
He definitely does have a lot of things going against him. And I don't know, there's actually not a lot of information provided about her sobriety during pregnancies. But I know that she does talk about, other people talk about her frequently trying to get sober mm-hmm. and like genuinely trying. And I want to give her that credit because in the 90s, there weren't the same resources for people in addiction. And like we said, even last episode, the resources for mental health on a whole were minuscule compared to today. But the picture I'm trying to paint here is a woman at the end of her rope. Beverly is essentially alone and juggling the stressors of life as a single parent, a child with behavioral issues, two grown children, working night after night, every night shift at a Dunkin' Donuts to make ends meet, and she's in addiction. She's not getting normal sleep, so her brain and circadian rhythm are off, and all of the important impacts that this has on how you function and your body, they're not working well either. Mm-hmm. She's in recurring active use, meaning she's spending money she likely doesn't have a lot of extra on drugs to avoid sickness. Her brain isn't working well because this seems to be a long-standing struggle. And if addiction can change the brain drastically in a short period of time, imagine what 20, 30 years might do to it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet through all of this, there's also financial and emotional stress in her life. And no matter what, yes, her children said they were at least physically taken care of, but that means she's giving up comfort for her to do that. She's either not spending money on drugs she needs to avoid being sick. She is sort of overriding that urge to use if she doesn't have money for it. And I'm going to trust the kids. I mean, like, obviously, they know their family and the highs and lows of that better than I ever would.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means that she tried to get sober over and over. And yeah, she might have failed, but she kept trying again, which meant she would face withdrawal. She'd go through that sickness and she'd still go to work and she'd still pay her bills and she'd still make sure the kids had what they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is commendable. Like, I think that is worth celebrating. And I want to point that out again, because I feel bad that later in this series, I don't get to say a lot of really nice things all in a row for Beverly.
Okay.
But I also just wanted to point out, I thought this was very sweet. In the New York Times article that I read, she was described as, again, having that tough exterior, but being so kind that every morning at the end of her shift, all of the leftover donuts that would otherwise get thrown away, she'd drop off at a homeless shelter on the way home. So, I mean, like, she's got a big heart. But while I don't believe an addiction disorder is someone's choice, I do believe that having children is. And where she did her absolute best, that doesn't necessarily mean that all of it from my point of view, was necessarily good.
Yeah.
Again, I believe what Carrie said. I take her opinion highly because she knows much better than I do what her family is like.
Mm.
But I say this because in June of 1994, this is the life the family was living. In a home in San Antonio, Jason, Beverly, and Nikki lived together. And while Beverly was struggling with this and working third shift, Nikki was on school break and likely breaking some laws. I mean, he was known to do that. And kids' behaviors rarely come from nowhere. But whether Nikki's were born out of nature or nurture, and honestly, probably a little bit of both, it didn't necessarily help all that much that Jason came home to help. Yes, initially, things seemed to get better. And this is pretty well known as a honeymoon phase that usually lasts from sometimes as short as days to months.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, it's like a few weeks to a few months. And then behaviors really start to uptick again. And this is something that we see a lot in like adoption or foster care, or even sometimes just if kids go away for like mental health treatment and come back home.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's excited to be reunited. And then now the boundaries get pushed. Now we're starting to feel it again. And like, you know, everything didn't magically change because one person was added. These things happen slowly over time. But in this case, Jason's return actually seemed to spark even more conflict in the home. They fought so often, cops were often called for domestic disturbances, neighbors heard fights, and in the documentary I watched on this, a few even felt comfortable speaking out about it on camera. One of Nikki's friends said that things got way worse when Jason came home, and a neighbor said that the cops were there all the time for domestic violence and disturbances.
Would this be related to Beverly and Jason?
It seemed like maybe Beverly and Jason, Nikki and either one of them. Like, it was kind of everybody was pissed at everybody.
Great.
Yeah.
That's good for a kid.
No, it's really comforting and healthy, probably.
Yes. Yep.
I will say, I haven't heard or seen any history of the police coming to arrest or have altercations with Beverly specifically over the substance use, but only in terms of conflict in the home and Nikki's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that was often. In fact, Nicholas had a sentencing hearing on June 14th for breaking and entering of a convenience store, which could have landed him in like a group home type of situation.
Mm-hmm.
And Nikki was not trying to have that happen.
Yes.
So on June 10th, 1994, when he hadn't come back from playing basketball with some friends, alarms didn't initially sound. Nikki called Jason, and Jason said he asked for a ride, but Jason couldn't or wouldn't give him a ride home from the park. It was like a mile away, and he was like, you walked there, you can walk back, like, come on.
Mm, okay.
Mom's sleeping, getting ready for work, like, no, just come home. Like,
yeah.
But when Nikki didn't show up that night, Beverly thought it was just another runaway attempt like the rest. Or that maybe he was trying to avoid going to that sentencing hearing and having to go to a group home. And she thought that maybe in the next day or so he'd be back. But when he wasn't back by June 13th, 3 days later, Beverly and Jason called the police to report him missing. And when Nikki was last seen, he had blonde hair, blue eyes. He had 3 stick and poke tattoos at 13.
Oh, no.
He was wearing black shoes, a white t-shirt, purple pants, and a pink backpack.
Okay.
He's got style, first of all. But also, you'd think that, like, you know, pink backpack, purple pants, like, these are pretty notable colors.
Sounds very 90s to me.
It's so 90s. But, like,
I can picture it.
Yep. Bright, you know, mm-hmm. Would stick out. Law enforcement came to respond, but had the same initial dismissal that Beverly did. They were so well acquainted with this home, and they knew Nicholas. He ran away a lot, like a lot. And with the court date being the next day, they pretty much decided to hold their breath to just see if he'd come back after the sentencing hearing had come and gone. But Nikki didn't come home again. Beverly said in the documentary that this wasn't news by any means. There was little to no media coverage of it, and if it was, it went no further than their hometown. Beverly did her best to advocate for Nikki, giving interviews and descriptions of what he was wearing, and even going as far as to talk about how loving and goofy he was despite all of the issues that he was struggling with, to sort of try to get people on their side to help look for him.
Yeah.
But they said it felt like they were the only ones trying. Carrie, who becomes increasingly important here, said that the only way she wasn't crying constantly was feeling like she could do something to help find Nikki. Sure, she lived outside the home with her own kids and family, but she had kids about Nikki's age, and this was her brother who was just gone. She helped hand out flyers and ask neighbors if they'd seen him in the days following with Jason and Beverly, but there was not a word. And unfortunately, this continued for a long time.
That's very sad.
Yeah. And especially like in these kinds of cases, you hear the usual sayings.
Mm-hmm.
The first 24 to 72 hours are the most important for missing children. He wasn't even reported missing until 72 hours later. But ultimately, most children who are reported missing return home. In fact, from an FBI statistic, over 99% of them. But for those that don't, that 1%, every second is vital. In 89% of cases where a missing child is not returned, a missing child who's abducted is dead within 24 hours, and over 75% are killed within the first 3 hours of their abduction.
Oh, no.
Waiting 3 days, having the police wait another two, and still hearing nothing had bleak chances for Nikki's family finding him. And that continued for years. Nikki's family is still holding out hope until they knew for sure, realizing repeatedly and assuredly that they seemed to be the only ones who cared to keep searching for Nikki.
Mm.
Then, out of the blue, a few months later, Jason called the police in September of 1994. He said he just saw Nikki trying to break into the house and immediately called it in for help. Since when he tried to go approach it, Nikki like ran away again after he was seen.
Okay.
And the police came, they checked it out with urgency, but ultimately they didn't have any evidence that Nikki was around at all, or that even a break-in was in the middle of happening. So they thought, you know, maybe it was a lie, but they really kind of chalked it up to Jason's grief or drug use. They said maybe he's seeing things that aren't there, or maybe he's just like convincing himself of things out of hope and desperation,
mm-hmm.
but nothing. And after that, there really wasn't a peep about Nikki or anything that might have happened to him. For years, with just each other to try to keep going and life having to be lived in the middle, the family came to accept that Nikki had probably died. Beverly believed Nikki probably took a ride from someone he shouldn't have. She said that he wasn't afraid of anybody, and if he wanted a ride to begin with, he probably would have accepted one if he was offered one. But despite all of this, she had hope that he might still be nearby, and the silence in his search didn't persuade them to give up hope of ever finding justice or bringing him home. They just slowly lost hope that he'd come home alive. And their family structure showed it, with more and more conflicts in the home between Beverly and Jason, eventually leading her to kick him out of the home entirely. Jason was also struggling with substance use, and I've heard anything from meth to coke to opiates or methadone. A New York Times article said that Jason was described as a coke addict with a hot temper, and I tend to trust their journalism, so even though I've heard a few things, I'm going to go with that.
Mm-hmm.
But with Jason's temper and Beverly's toughness, the family was falling apart. And poor Carrie was just trying to hold everyone together while raising her own kids at the same time. The fight wasn't over for Nikki, but the fight was spilling over into the home too. That is, until a miracle happened.
Okay.
And one day, 3 years later in 1997... Carrie got a call from Nikki, ready to come home.
Really?
Yes. This never in our wildest dreams scenario seemed to be staring them all directly in the face. In early October of 1997, Curie got a phone call from none other than the police in Linares, Spain. Remember, we're in Texas. So Curie was told Nikki was on the phone, and when she was given the phone, she exclaimed, "Oh my God, Nikki, is that you?" And he said, "Yes, it's me."
Okay.
Immediately, Curie got thrust into the excitement and ordeal of finding her long-lost brother to bring him home. Jason and Beverly hadn't been the same since, and because Curie had a solid job and partner, Brian, she was able to volunteer to go bring him home. Authorities were convinced, and Carrie's job even offered to pay for her to go. So shout out to them.
Wow.
Curie went to Spain and presumably got acquainted with the FBI agent on the case, Nancy Fisher. I know she was one of probably many, but she is one that sticks with the family for a while here. Mm-hmm. And so Curie had to go, you know, overseas. She went to Spain, probably for the first time in her life outside of the country. I know it would be mine, you know. Yeah. And once she met up with the man in Spain claiming to be her brother, she'd have to identify him before they could bring him home. And although a technicality, Carrie's identification would be what got Nicholas a passport to come back to the U.S. and for the case to be considered closed, right? For him to be found and returned. They have to know it's him that was found and returned.
Right.
So there were some differences from when he left, but Curie felt in her gut that this was him. She rushed towards him immediately to hug him and noted how his nose looked so much like her uncle's. And he still had that cross stick and poke tattoo on his hand and it was uncovered. And she was like, oh my God.
Yep.
And despite the fact that some things had changed, like he started growing stubble and had darker hair and eyes, she believed this to be explained by the traumatic abduction that he had. And the next day, they were on a flight to San Antonio together, Curie elated and excited, and Nicholas now quiet and anxious. Upon arrival, Nicholas and Curie were welcomed by the entire family. Curie's husband, Brian, and her kids, Cody and Chantel, were there. Beverly was there, and friends and family, too. The only one who didn't come was Jason, and to my knowledge, that's because he was, I think, in a rehab in a nearby, like, town and couldn't make it.
Okay.
Everyone was ecstatic to see him, but, like, you know, trying to make him feel comfortable. Like, here's this kid you thought was dead for years. He comes back. He's clearly been through some shit.
And so he was 13 when he went missing. They see him 3 years later. So now he's 16. He looks different. He's grown up. He's taller. He's taller.
He's growing facial hair.
Right.
He's quiet. He's anxious. They're like, oh, something happened to you.
Right. Because that was not his personality beforehand.
Right. And so he seemed notably shy and anxious, but they thought like maybe just overwhelmed from the homecoming, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Beverly said despite wanting to, like, run up and squeeze the hell out of him, she, like, hung out for a second before going up. And I think she eventually gave in to temptation and gave him a hug. But, like, held his hand, like, to the car and everything. Like, she missed her son.
I'm surprised that the police were like, okay, he's home. I'm like, what about the people that took him?
Yeah.
Like, what?
So, I'll give you a little bit of a spoiler alert, I guess, but it's not a big one at all.
Mm.
He was found in a phone booth in Spain, clearly upset, overwhelmed. He had like a hoodie pulled down over his eyes. He was like shivering in this box. It was raining outside.
Mm.
And a man called saying that him and his wife on a tour, like they were tourists, saw him in there, and he was obviously a kid who was afraid and he didn't have any documentation. So he wasn't with anybody when he was taken. And this didn't stop the investigation from continuing in the U.S.
Okay.
But this just got him home.
Gotcha.
So the family still tried to make the return as comfortable and as sweet as possible. They put on tapes of his favorite music, probably Michael Jackson. He was obsessed. To make him feel better and more comfortable. Curie said that everyone was quiet but so excited. She said, "I couldn't keep a smile off of my face at the time. I just had a grin the whole way home."
And they have to be so relieved because at that point they were not expecting him to be found alive.
Right.
Like they were like, this, if we do find him, it will be remains that we can bring home.
Right.
And now he's standing there.
And now he's there in the flesh.
So yeah, I don't know how you would stop smiling. I don't know how Beverly could have resisted not just like scooping him up.
I know. I know. So as the family got more settled, Nicholas was having a hard time opening up and settling in. He kind of started to ease in, but he was still pretty quiet. He didn't remember the shared memories they hoped he would, and the family, rightfully, thought he was traumatized. He didn't remember things because he had been through something awful in the years since, and to sort of try to get him more comfortable and ease back in, they thought the best thing for him would be to get him into a routine. So they'd try to hang out, they'd eat meals together. Carrie's husband, Brian, would take him for drives. They'd just, like, listen to music and drive around. And Nicholas would hang out after school with old friends, talk on the phone. He even got a little crush on this girl named Amy, and he'd get kind of blushy if people talked about it.
Oh, so, like, returning more to normal life.
Yes.
Being a regular 16-year-old kid, getting all nervous and hormonal and weird and...
Going to school, getting a little crush. And they really believed that in all the ways that he had changed, that he'd open up to them and tell them about what happened to him while he was gone when he was ready.
In his own time.
Right. Which I have to say is honestly probably the most trauma-informed approach they could have taken. A schedule and a routine is vital for kids. It makes them feel secure, like they know what's going to happen. And for a kid who was abducted for 3 years, he probably needs to know what's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
even if he can't say it. And also, like, you can't really force somebody to share trauma that happened to them. Those are all, I think, really good steps that they took.
Mm-hmm.
Now, beyond the family, the government was also trying to do their best to make sure that Nicholas was safe, put his case to rest, and generally, like, do their due diligence in serving justice. They wanted to connect Nicholas with and his family with the resources, but also hear more about the abduction. Because what the hell do you mean you showed up 3 years later in Spain?
Right. How'd they smuggle you over there?
How'd they smuggle you over borders into another country? So Agent Nancy Fisher thought that it was pertinent to interview him quickly to get this account of his kidnapping. And although, just a trigger warning going into this section, there is a lot of mention of torture, sexual assault, and rape, and all of it involving children. Just proceed with caution. Anyways, the agent said that when she saw him, she didn't really believe that he matched the appearance of a 16-year-old boy. Agent Fisher noted that he had the shadow of a full beard that was dark, which was strange considering he was 16 and blonde.
So he had like a 5 o'clock shadow, basically.
Yeah. And it looked like it was dark stubble, which for a blonde kid seems strange. She also said he looked nervous and uncomfortable, but at the time,
to be expected,
he always was. Right. Yeah. And Agent Fisher began to interview Nicholas to find out what had happened to him. I do just want to say, I loved the documentary I watched on this. So what I'm about to tell you, Nicholas reported, came directly from Agent Fisher's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Where she read directly from the notes she took from this interview.
Okay, got
it. So this is as close to like a firsthand account of what he said that we can get.
Yeah, I mean, it is a firsthand account of what he said.
Yeah. So essentially, Nicholas said that he was taken by military officials.
Okay.
I believe he said that he was chloroformed, abducted, and put into a van before getting put onto a plane. He reported he was blindfolded the whole time and he never saw where he was going. He never knew where he was, but eventually found he had been taken overseas by these military men and put into a child sex trafficking ring. Nicholas reported that he was kept in a room with other kids, that they'd get chloroformed sometimes and wake up somewhere new. And throughout the years, getting put into military planes and flown all over the world without knowing or being able to see where they were going at all. But they were subject to sexual abuse by high-ranking military officials. He said they were being raped and molested by men, and Nicholas described these men as American, Mexican, and European. And beyond that, they would sell him and other kids for sex.
Okay, so that is the worst of the worst
mm-hmm.
that you could imagine a child going through.
But that wasn't all. To keep all of these kids in line, they were subject to awful torture. Nicholas reported that they broke his hands and repeatedly broke his right hand with a baseball bat and even broke his left foot with a crowbar, which, by the way, just so we know, they did confirm in like x-rays that this had happened. All of the kids there were tortured, burned. They were given insects to eat. He said that these abductors would keep them in line with military scare tactics, but also torturous experiments that they were put through. Nicholas said these experiments included getting needles put in their eyes and having experiments done to them. Like, one had headphones that were screaming and yelling forced over their ears just like for hours. One had Spanish playing over and over again, just saying, "You are not you." Just over and over.
So they're like psychologically torturing them just as much as they're physically torturing them.
Yes. He said that if any of the kids spoke English, they would be beaten. And further, some of their experiments changed their eye color and hair color. That's how his eyes and hair turned brown. And he did have like kind of a funny accent, but he was like, yeah, that happened because I wasn't allowed to speak English. Like, I wasn't allowed to, or I'd get the shit beat out of me. My words, not his. And then one day, miraculously, one of the military men accidentally left a door open, or like not clicked all the way closed.
Mm-hmm.
And Nicholas said he seized the opportunity. He ran through it, and there was this big hallway where he kept running until there was another door, and he freaked out, but he found a way out of it. I don't know if that was locked or not. And then he was outside. And then he said he just didn't stop. He just kept running for like hours because he didn't know if he was being followed. And eventually the day turned into night and it started raining. So he hid in the phone booth. And that's when the man and his wife who found him called.
Okay, so he probably looked pretty terrible.
Yeah, pretty bad. Terrified.
Right, but I just mean like potentially bloodied, not wearing appropriate clothing. Like, this kid had obviously been through something that it wasn't like this kid's upset and doesn't want to go home.
Right.
It's like this kid doesn't have home.
Right.
And he's been traumatized.
And I think it also makes sense. It makes more sense in my brain then, like, why if this man and his wife approached him, he wouldn't want to talk. He probably doesn't trust anybody. He probably doesn't know who's who.
They might think that they're in on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He didn't learn until he ran outside of that building that he was in Spain. So he might not even know what they're fucking saying.
Wow.
And that's Nicholas's abduction story. And look, Agent Fisher is a professional. I mean, she's a fucking FBI agent.
Mm-hmm.
But she's absolutely fucking horrified. Like, this is a horrendous interview. And of course she was shaken by it.
Mm-hmm.
There are horrendous side effects to being subject to a firsthand account of this kind of trauma. And she didn't doubt it at all because people don't lie about things like this. And like, in the chance he was, how did he learn that stuff like this exists?
Well, and how did he have the injuries if they did the
right
scans on him and everything and looked at x-rays and could see that it corroborated what he was saying? Then I don't think he made it up.
Right. And he had torture written all over him. Carrie's husband, Brian, said he walked with a limp and that his right hand that was broken never healed right.
Yeah, it's not like they took him to the doctor afterwards.
Yeah, he had cigarette burns all down his neck and on his ankles.
Hmm.
But Agent Fisher told him and his family that she was so incredibly sorry about what he'd been through and that she was going to put an end to this trauma and find these fucking people. Again, the fucking was my words, not hers.
You know she was thinking it.
Mm-hmm. So Nicholas was able to go home, and Agent Fisher got to work trying to find out who in the world could have done this to him. But she did ask him not to do any interviews or tell people outside of the home, because if these were high-ranking military officials, especially U.S. ones, she knew that if anybody got this out, that they could be tipped off, that they could possibly do something, and she didn't want to give them a fucking inch to know that they were onto them.
Yeah.
But this is where we meet perhaps my favorite player in this case, Charlie Parker, PI.
Ooh, okay.
He's my fucking favorite. So private investigator Charlie Parker, a now older man with white hair, was working as a private investigator, but like I think was kind of getting one-off gigs from different places at times.
Yeah.
And he had kind of a standing working relationship with this television program called The Hard Copy. It might still be running, I don't know, but it's kind of like, from what I understand, info entertainment. I think like The View, all those interview shows and like morning TV where it's like a little bit kitschy. It's like a little entertaining. They're like, so did you know what I heard? I saw this movie trailer for Enter Ad Here, that kind of thing.
Right. Usually and, you know, pretty cringy.
Cringy, but sometimes they get like good people to interview when shit's going on.
Yeah, every once in a while they might pull one up.
That was my take on it. I could be wrong, but yeah, that's what I understood. Be.
I love this PI already, though. He sounds like a hoot and a half, and I'd love to have a beer with him.
So fucking fun. I love him.
And I don't even drink beer, but I would force that to hear his stories for
Literally. But The Hard Copy heard about this. I mean, again, like, who gets a story like this? It's fascinating. A young American boy gets abducted and presumed dead for years before showing up in another country later.
They're like, we can capitalize off of this.
Yes. So Charlie is the kind of investigator I'd hope to be, because he's so badass from what I've seen of him, and also he's just fucking good at it. He tracked down where Beverly, Nicholas's mother, is living, and from there he drove there and asked Nicholas to do an interview, which of course he isn't supposed to do, but in true Nicky fashion, of course he does.
Mm.
So it's not with Charlie. Charlie kind of like sets it up for them. His job was to find them, but right. He did get to be present for the interview with The Hard Copy. So on this interview, first, I just want to tell you how fucking insane banana pants Nicholas looks. I don't normally say this, but this outfit is fucking whack. Okay. He's got like a big fedora. He's got a leather jacket and he's got these huge sunglasses on, and it just looks crazy. Again, think all of this is happening in 1997. Like, we were not a fashion icon at this time.
Oh my.
And he's doing this interview and telling his story, and he goes through everything that happens. It airs on the 5 o'clock news, but Charlie, again, he gets to be there during the recording of it. And Charlie feels like something's off. He said Nicholas had no tells of being an abused boy. There were no heavy pauses or tears, no dissociation, just cold facts about what occurred. And then Charlie describes this moment where he got like full body chills, because pinned up to the like cube or little corner that he was working in was a photo of young Nicky. One of the photos that they gave out when he went missing, and like him as a boy.
Right.
And he said now, 3 years later, he had a full dark beard, or not beard, but you know what I mean? Like, he was able to grow a full beard. It was dark stubble. He had dark hair and dark eyes and a French accent, kind of. Indiscernible European, not fully French, but like French Spanish.
Mm.
And he was like, okay, yeah, but like, you can't use that. Like, obviously the experiments that he had to go through accounted for those things. He was like, I mean, I haven't heard of an experiment that changes the color of your eyes, but like, it's an experiment, you know, who's to say it's not new. But as he was mulling it over, he remembered something called the Scotland Yard method. Because he just had a gut feeling. He couldn't really pinpoint it. But then he remembered that the Scotland Yard method was used to track down the man who assassinated Martin Luther King Jr.
Okay.
It essentially uses the ears as a unique identifier, much like fingerprints, because mm-hmm. ears have very unique folds and shapes that don't change over time.
Right.
So, you know, some people have like a funky shaped tragus where there's like a point up top, but some of them are just all rounded. Like, there's a lot of different unique parts to an ear that people could have.
Making me self-conscious about my ears right now.
Don't be. They're beautiful. They're yours.
Thank you, babe.
So then he yanks this photo off the booth. It's a little sticky fingies. I kind of like it. But he yanks this photo and he's like, mine now. I'm keeping it. And then I don't know if he like screen captures the TV that it's on later, or if he takes a photo in the moment, or if he has somebody send over a photo. But he gets a photo from the interview and he starts fucking around in Photoshop, one of my favorite activities. And again, my words, not his. Mm. And he zooms in on the picture of Nicholas's ear from the interview and the ear in the photo that baby Nikki had. And they are not the same ear.
Okay.
So he knows without a doubt, this is not Nicholas Barclay. In fact, he thought he had a spy from Europe, because who the fuck else would do this?
So not only does he think that this isn't Nikki, he's like, this is a spy.
Well, he's like, I can't imagine any other person that would do this. Like, it has to be like something like that. So he's freaked out. He's like panicking himself. But he's like, this is not Nicholas Barclay. I don't know what he's doing here. Like, this isn't right.
Okay. So
he calls up our girl, Agent Fisher. Uh-huh. He says, Nance, this guy isn't real. The ears don't match.
And she's like, it's 7 o'clock in the morning.
Literally, she was like, hey, bud, okay. But this is an ongoing federal investigation and you don't need to be caught in the middle of it. So pipe down. Mm-hmm. Also, she thought it was real because his family thought so. Like, who is she to question his family saying, this is my brother?
Yeah.
But to his credit, Charlie was like, okay, maybe I came on strong. People aren't used to getting calls about ears.
Like, yeah, he's right for that.
Yeah, he was like, I meant it and I'm worried, but like, all right.
the approach could have been a little bit more tactful. Uh-huh.
Again, I don't know if that was the words of the conversation, but that was the gist.
But and that's, yeah.
Both of them were giving interviews in this documentary, and I was like, this is hysterical.
He doesn't strike me as, like, beating around the bush. He's going to call her and say, it's the ears, Nance, it's the ears.
Nance, the ears do not match.
Nance, jot that down. It's the ears.
And so he kind of accepts like her response, but he is worried because he's like, if this isn't Nicholas, what is this man gonna do and what is he doing here? If he's a spy or a terrorist, like, he's living with this family, he's going to school, he's on the bus, he's in like classes with other kids.
Yeah, who is this person that who we just sent back into this kid's life?
Is this person?
Yeah.
But our girl doubted this strongly. I mean, what child could make up lies so horrid, and what family wouldn't know their own son? So she was going to figure it out, and she wasn't going to let more kids suffer. But the maybe Nicholas's trauma was so bad that as she tried to continue to question him about this abduction and like what could have happened overseas, he just couldn't remember names or faces or timelines or places. Which, yes, I mean, he said that he was blindfolded anytime they were moved. So, like, the places kind of make sense. But I feel like after 3 years, you'd maybe get someone slipping and calling someone else a name.
Or, like, even the other kids. Can you tell anything about the other kids that were there? But here's the thing. There's one thing they can do.
Yep.
That can determine if this is him, that does not rely on his memory. DNA test.
We'll get that.
This is the fact that they didn't do that, like, in Spain.
Yeah, that shocks me,
right?
I don't know. Maybe that I think perhaps that could be a standard of operation now, but clearly it wasn't then.
That is wild.
So she's like, all right, listen, I get this. I understand how trauma impacts the brain and memory because Nancy is a boss. But she goes, all right, we're going to do what we can. There is a really great forensic interviewer, mm-hmm, kind of, for children, specifically in Houston. So she takes Nicholas with her and they fly to Houston. I actually personally don't know how far away San Antonio and Houston are. They're both in Texas, but I know Texas is huge. And I know they flew.
Well, let's find out. According to my Google search, mm-hmm, it is a 2 hour and call it 3 hour drive, okay, 197 miles. So probably like a half hour flight.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe.
So real fast. That's interesting. I do know they flew. I don't know necessarily why.
It would take 5 hours by train. And that's, I'm assuming, no traffic.
Got it. Okay.
The more you know.
The more. So Dr. Bruce Perry, MD, PhD, worked at the Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. He went into the interview hoping to find more information about the people who abducted Nikki. And Dr. Perry said, here was this pale white kid. I introduced myself and he spoke back. But he immediately felt like something was wrong and not right here. He, too, didn't see any posture change or body language of someone who had been through this kind of trauma. But more than that, the maybe Nicholas couldn't speak English without an accent.
Mm-hmm.
And this told him more about the development of maybe Nicholas's brain than anything else. But what he knew about cognition and development was that you cannot be raised for the first, even like 6 or 7 years of your life in an English-speaking home and not be able to return to the language without an accent.
Mm-hmm.
So any language you learn, even if you get like phenomenal at that, whenever you start to speak your native language, you're going to have your native accent.
Right.
Which meant he knew that this person was not raised by an English-speaking home, and therefore he believed him to not be an American at all.
Uh-huh.
So Dr. Perry said from that interview he could guarantee that this was not Nicholas Barclay because he knew for a fact that this man was not an American.
Oh my God. So and he's living in their house?
He's living in their home.
He's sleeping in Nikki's bed?
Yeah, he is calling Carrie and Jason, his family. He's calling Beverly mom. He's going to school.
Oh.
So he calls Agent Fisher and he tells her his results. And she's so funny. I think she's hysterical. But in this interview, she was like, obviously, I didn't like that. Like, that's the worst case scenario that could have just happened.
Yes.
And so she said this case changed entirely. And she called Carrie because Carrie was supposed to pick him up at the airport, right? Bring him home.
Mm-hmm.
So she calls Carrie and she goes, Carrie, Dr. Perry just stated this person cannot be your brother for the fact that he cannot be an American. This could be a very dangerous person.
Yeah.
And she recalled Carrie like kind of screaming and going, you know, like, oh, my gosh, and trying to figure out what to do. And Nancy was like, OK, girl, don't worry about it. Just don't be at the airport. You don't have to take him back into your home. Like, I'll deal with it once we get there. But like, just don't be there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't show up. And naturally, they're away for this interview. So she doesn't want to tip off whoever this is, the not so Nicholas, that she knows he's not so Nicholas.
Yep. You know?
So she's trying to like be normal. They're going back. They get to the airport. They fly to San Antonio.
I like not so Nicholas.
But there was Carrie at the airport.
Carrie, come on, girl.
She met them at the gate, smiling and happy.
Good.
She hugged Not-So-Nicholas upon arrival. Like, the call never even happened.
So Carrie doesn't know how to take an answer. And just, you know, the FBI lady said, don't do it. And she's like, better yet, I'll do it.
Well, I'm just confused because she, like, on the phone is like, oh, my God, what?
And then Does she just want to see for her own eyes? Does she just want to try to confirm and like search the guy's face?
No. I mean, she hugged him. She like brought him in. There was like not a moment.
Okay, so she didn't talk to Carrie? Nancy Fisher could have had this conversation with somebody she thought was Carrie on the phone. Was it not Carrie?
Oh, I mean, she believed it to be Carrie.
Okay. Well, if Carrie's still there anyway and is absolutely not at all fazed by the fact that this isn't her brother... I don't think she spoke with Carrie.
Maybe.
Or Carrie's got some problems.
Maybe.
Either with authority or other things.
Yeah.
Got it.
But that, dear listener, is where I'm leaving you.
Oh, what the fuck?
For the end of part one.
No. No.
Yeah.
Nope. Nope. Next Keep week. Going. No.
Next week, you can join us for the rest of the investigation into Not-So-Nicholas. And what other shocking turn we find about what happened.
You know what this reminds me of?
Hmm.
In Benchwarmers, where, if you haven't seen the movie, you should. And they put this guy, Carlos, on the team. And it's like, he's like, I am 12. And he shows his birth certificate and it says, I am 12. And it's a picture of a 30-year-old man.
Yeah, he's 30, but it's like written in crayon.
Correct. Yeah, this is that to me. Yeah.
Except this is like if he was coming into somebody's home and said, Mommy, I'm home. And then his mom said, Baby, you're home.
So here was what I was thinking. When you said that his hair got darker and his eyes changed color, I was like, I don't buy that. Because that's kind of like, hair can get darker.
Yeah.
I think over time, absolutely. Like, you see kids born with like really light blonde hair, and then it, when it, they get older, it's like a light brown.
Yeah.
But the eye color thing really threw me off. But we did spend time talking about Beverly and her substance use, and that, you know, she, I don't know, was probably at work during the night, sleeping, or just incapacitated during the day.
Yeah.
The siblings were there and not, and Jason himself has some substance use issues that I'm just thinking, like, would they even really notice his hair or eye color that much? Like, would their memories serve that? How often did they see the kid?
Right.
You know, like, that's their brother and that's Beverly's son. But, like, realistically, with everything we talked about in the first half of this episode that was going on with that family.
Yeah.
Would they have really remembered his eye color? Like, could they have just thought it looked like... And they wanted it to be him so bad that they found all the ways that it could look similar.
Right.
But I have to say, I did cheat and I looked up pictures.
Yeah.
Who the fuck is that? Who is that man?
Yeah.
Who is that grown man?
Yes.
So you guys, that's wild. Oh my God.
Next time, we're going to cover everything from the reveal of Not So Nicholas to a prison sentence to dancing to Michael Jackson and Interpol.
Ma'am.
Yeah.
I'm on the edge of my flabbers are gassed. My ass is astounded.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a, and by good, I mean like insane. Like, you just never know what's coming next, because this is not the craziest part of what happens.
Nicholas needs to Vincent Van Gogh, though. Like, he needs to get out of that house. Like,
yeah, the Not So Nicholas.
He's got a blast.
Yeah.
Because I feel like once you realize there is a stranger in your home, like, their son, likely, if he is alive, would probably return to them like a stranger, given that it's been years and who knows what he's been through.
Yeah.
But now that you know for a fact that this is just actually not him.
Yeah.
And, like, the accent didn't fade. And yeah, his, he was blonde hair, blue eyed, and now he's dark hair, brown eyed.
Sorry, I'm just looking at Not So Nicholas. It's so fucking fun. It's like ridiculous. Yes, that's how he looked.
That is Heath Ledger and Kurt Cobain. Rest in peace.
Yes,
like if they had a love child. That is not. That's not Nicholas.
No, the nose is different. The mouth is different. The eyes are different. The eyebrows are different.
The eyebrows, the eyes, the nose, the lips, the facial structure, the color of the hair. And he has coconut head hair.
He does.
Too, which that's an aside.
Isn't that crazy?
That is neither here nor there, but that is very unfortunate.
And this man has the same tattoo?
Yeah, but that's easy enough to get.
Crazy.
This, okay. So this is so much worse.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Huh?
That's a man.
That is a man.
That's a man you sent to public school.
Yeah, that's a man that was sitting in algebra at one point.
That's what you call a liability.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So this is a fun one. Well, see you next time for what happens to Not So Nicholas, which is something.
Not So Nicholas seems to be Northeastern European to me.
Oh, yeah. Good call. Good call. That is where he was found.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he, yeah. okay. That's different.
If you guys want to see what we're talking about, go check it out on the Instagram. You can always see the people, who place. The
fuck is that? Sorry. Who is that? Oh, no. I don't mean to laugh because there's a real, like, innocent kid in this who is missing and we still don't know. But I think that they were trying to convince themselves so bad that he was found because they wanted him to be found so bad that they completely overlooked that this is just a random man.
This is a random man. Yeah. No, you guys should look up the pictures. It's pretty funny. If you want to see what we're talking about, go to our Instagram. You can see all the people, places, things that we're talking about here, including not so Nicholas, who is really not so Nicholas at all.
His nose is completely different. Oh, I can't stop.
Oh, you guys, it's so nuts. This is real. People do this.
I know, but I have to exit out because I can't stop laughing. Oh, no.
Oh, it's bad. You can also send us pictures of your pod pets. If you have a pod pet that has a fedora, oh, my God, send it, please. You could also do that to our email or send us your thoughts. You could send that to our email. Send us your thoughts, feelings, ideas, theories. Do you know this case? Let us know down below too. If you're on Spotify, you can scroll up and leave a comment. But we love you so much. Leave a 5-star review anywhere you go. And if I check my watch, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Who believed that?
I am 12.
No.